Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today I want to welcome Bruce Fenton. He is a data scientist currently researching in the areas of technosignatures, genomic SETI, panspermia, and paleoanthropology. His research activities have been featured in the UK's Telegraph newspaper, Science Channel's Unexplained Files, and History's Ancient Aliens. He is the science feature editor for Earth Ancients podcast and is also a regular guest speaker on radio shows around the globe. He has written several books, and today we'll be discussing his book, Exogenesis Human Hybrids, A Scientific History of Extraterrestrial Genetic Manipulation. Bruce, welcome. How are you doing today?
No, I'm doing very well. Appreciate the kind introduction, and I'm doing well despite, you know, strange times that we're living in, but yeah, I'm pretty well.
Yes, definitely strange times we are living in. You know, I love to take a break from that, from my shows, and looking forward to this one. You know, I believe that the history that's hidden from us as humans is the key to understanding not only what we are as humans, where we came from, our purpose here, and the hidden reality that suggests that we may have been upgraded us at some point in our past, possibly by advanced beings. Mm-hmm. And I think it's essential to explore this so we can not only understand ourselves, but even the nature of reality. Bruce, I'd love to start today with a little bit more about your background and what got you looking into our ancient past.
Sure. My beginnings in the sort of ancient mysteries and paranormal kind of topics goes right back to when I was around 12 years old. My grandmother used to give me these, they were little collectible cards. I mean, I don't know how to best describe them, but it basically on each card, you would get details about one mystery, say like the crystal skulls, pyramids, yetis, you know, all the classics. I mean, it was 40 different cards to collect, and they came free with tea leaves that she would buy. Now, so this is going back a few decades ago. I think it was PG or Typhi, one of these big tea companies, and they just had these, for whatever reason, they used to have these collectible cards. And so, you know, I used to read all these little mysteries and think, well, you know, there's obviously all these strange things I don't know about the world. And it really kind of triggered an interest, which has obviously spiraled on, you know, into more serious studies. But that's where it began. And I think even before that, though, I had an interest in fossil collecting and, you know, so the ancient past, the mysterious, you know, the lost worlds, and that kind of side of things, really, I guess, right from very, very early was a natural interest. Of course, as you get older, you know, you get access to more serious books. You know, I began this sort of deep dive and learned about the ancient Egyptians, the mysteries there, you know, who built the pyramids, the kind of classics, had experiences of my own with psychical and paranormal events. So that pulled me into those areas as well. So it was really years and years of a mixture of the paranormal interest and the ancient mysteries, which have kind of led on then to aliens, you know, and ancient aliens.
You said you had a few personal experiences. Would you mind briefly telling us about some of those experiences?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first one that stands out to me is I remember being around about, I think, probably 15, and just having this sudden knowing that a close family member was in trouble. Particularly, I had this feeling, you know, that they'd been in some, you know, in legal troubles. And it turned out that they indeed, this person had been arrested at the time there was illegal raids in the UK, where people just go to a field, you know, and they'd set up and have a party. And he'd been roped in with a load of people there who'd been taken off to the cells. But, you know, it was really funny. So I actually went out of the house, I was kind of standing on the road and thinking, I just got this really strange feeling that, you know, something's happened to him. And so that was the first time I had what I suppose you'd think of as a kind of a telepathic kind of experience, you know, sensing a family member's problems from far away. Other than that, yeah, that kind of increased over the late teen to early 20s, where, you know, I would pick up things about people, including their names in some cases, you know, complete strangers, you know. So that kind of led to me understanding there was clearly, you know, something there, like, you know, telepathy, a psychic ability. But I wanted to understand from a scientific point of view, what does that mean? You know, what does it tell us about consciousness and about our reality? Because clearly it didn't mesh with anything that school, you know, had taught me about human beings and how we function, right? So having it yourself, when you have those experiences, you realize that it's not just made up, you know, woo-woo, new age or something, but there's a genuine phenomena at work. And so that's really why I got particularly interested in the paranormal, is these personal, strange, intuitive experiences. So they're not directly linked to the ancient past, but of course we do see a lot of writings about, you know, strange powers in ancient texts. So there is, of course, a link in there that, you know, the ancients often do refer here and there to these abilities in their texts, right? So that there is definitely some overlap in those subjects.
Definitely. I agree 100%. So as far as your book, I'd like you to start with explaining who is Valerie Barrow and mm-hmm. how did you, come across her work and get started with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably, her work's probably a little bit obscure. So it was through a kind of a chain of, I guess you'd say, like synchronicities. I don't know if listeners would know her work, and if they do, they may well know it through, you know, my work possibly. Because what happened was I was involved with a mysterious megalithic complex in the Amazon jungle. This is going back to about 2013, 2014, when I was living at the time over in Ecuador. Now, this site ended up linking me into a mysterious group of people called the Lagoa Santa. Now, if anyone doesn't know them, the Lagoa Santa were a population down in Brazil, living somewhat, 20,000 plus years ago. Well, surviving on past that, but there's sites there that go back beyond 20,000 years. And some a bit more recent, up to the kind of younger Dryas, the 12,000 years ago, when we know that a lot was going on in the world. It's like a comet impact and, other things happened that seems to have eradicated most of their culture. Now, like, what does that have to do with Valerie Barrow? The thing is, it turns out that these Lagoa Santa, their fossil, the remains, appear to be Aboriginal Australian type morphology, right? Which is super weird, because the people of the Americas are supposed to be Asiatic. Yeah, so we find these Clovis sites and these early Americans, usually the features are of Asian people. Okay, so there's something that is clearly not right with the story if you've got an older population down in South America who appear to be Aboriginal Australians, right? So this is where the connection took me to Australia. Now, I ended up in contact with a couple of researchers over there, Stephen and Evan Strong, who also, they talk about the possibility of an ancient origin for humans in Australia and these kind of topics, as well as a link into possible alien visitation. And so that kind of connected me into that topic. We collaborated on a book called Ancient Aliens in Australia. Now, so that actually came out in 2013. And from them is how I ended up this contact to Valerie, because they had met her and they were sort of aware of her work. And in fact, in some respects, they said it was knowing about her claims that validated in a way the things that myself and my wife were saying about these visitors, because she said it sounded like the same kind of, the same beings or the same backstory was linking Valerie's work and ours. And so they recommended her book, which is called Alcheringa, When the First Ancestors Were Created. And so my wife and I read that after completing writing our book. I think right at the end of when we were writing our book, because we included just a brief mention of her work in there. And then, we sort of realized that it felt like it was a true story of a visitation, genetic manipulation of early hominins, and a whole longer story that we can get into. But that's how I linked into her. So it was through a few different leaps in the research and a few different synchronicities.
If you could give us an overview about what is in the book, mm-hmm. And what kind of set you off on that research.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a tale. I'll start by saying that, it's one of those books, if you read it, she doesn't make a claim to say, hey, this is, you should believe all this, it's true, we've got all this evidence. In fact, I'll just start by saying at the end, she says, if it resonates with you, fine, believe it. If not, I understand, kind of thing, because it's so extraordinary and there's not strong supporting evidence in the book, right? So she obviously gets it that for a lot of people it's been a struggle. And the reason why is because, it tells the tale of how an object, an Aboriginal object, ended up coming to her home. Now, this is called a Cheringa. And for anyone who's not familiar, Tjeringas are ancient sacred artifacts of certain Aboriginal populations. Now, one of which I believe is the Arente people from around Uluru, and also a couple of other tribal groups that they also have these artifacts in their mythology and physically in their culture. But not all Aboriginal Australians would talk about Tjeringas. Our Tjeringa is the dream time. Tjeringa is obviously related to the dream time. Now, they're supposed to be objects that contain the spirit of beings from the Our Tjeringa time, this dream time when the first ancestors were created, when many of the features in the landscape and the animals were created. So it links right back to this period of, you know, mystical sacred creation forces, visitation by beings, so spirit beings, all of that's in the stories, right? And so we have this strange series of events where a lady comes to Valerie's house saying, you know, I have this artifact. I'm trying to get it back to its custodians, which I believe is the people around Uluru, the Arente. And he's trying to do that. But this lady's very unwell and says, can you temporarily look after this object? Because your house is called Our Tjeringa. I think it's like a synchronicity that I meant to leave it with you temporarily because it's from the Our Tjeringa time. And both of these people being somewhat mystically inclined, you know, Valerie is okay with that. She accepts that, okay, you know, I'll look after this object temporarily. And then almost immediately she starts having sort of, I suppose, what we'd call like a download of sorts, that there is a voice, you know, an imagery, information that is appearing directly into her mind. And there's a voice that tells her, you know, I'm Our Tjeringa, you know, I'm this being from the Our Tjeringa time, a star person's energy that is here to reveal a lost story of humanity and human origins. And it essentially gives her a whole overview of a arrival of a craft, genetic engineering, all sorts of stuff, right? And then tells her, you will also hear this story from other people. You know, you're going to start meeting people and they're going to tell you the same story and revalidate it to you, right? It seems like it's weird enough, right? You've got this object in your house, okay? You know, you're getting this strange download, obviously very strange, you know, asking yourself first, have you gone mad? You know, what is going on? And then you're being told, you know, you're going to meet people and they're going to tell you this same story of an alien visitation. You know, it seems really unlikely, right? So, but funnily enough, it ended up with about, I think it's around 30 or so different people that she did indeed meet, you know, some of whom she knew already, some people she met through her work, and other people totally random that would come up to her and say, you know, I have something to share with you, and would start telling her, I remember being in this ancient time when there was an alien visitation. And so in the end, she ended up, with about 30 or so people giving her pieces of the same story again back to her, until, so, you know, in two ways, she got this story of visitation from the object and from these people who seem to have past life memories. So it's a really extraordinary case.
Now, as far as the stones, what do you think? Do you think it is some sort of consciousness that was left in the stones, or like a transmitter? But how do you think this, you know, that worked with the communication from the stone to her consciousness?
Sure. Well, the way that I've explained this in the new book, you know, Exogenesis, which is out 1st of June, obviously people be able to get a broader explanation. But the way I explain it in there is I said, well, look, if we consider what we know of in our sciences and, you know, where our great thinkers, if you like, the philosophers and space scientists and all the rest of it, what do they think about, you know, what would we encounter with an advanced alien race, right? And one of the ideas that they've come up with over the years is this thing called a Bracewell probe, right, which is an artificial intelligence loaded into a, you know, what would likely be a small compact probe, which you can either distribute out into space or you can leave on planets. And they act as what they call sentinel probes, right? That, you know, once you say place one on a planet, it can sit there recording information. And also, one of the things that's hypothesized is that at some point, say like a civilization emerges on a planet, then eventually it can detect the radio waves or the energy waves from that civilization's technology and become, you know, active to making contact, and can actually make contact on behalf of the extraterrestrial civilization that left it there, right? So if you put that into that context, there's a very, very close overlap between the narrative that we're seeing here and, you know, what is expected. And this is one of the funny things that, you know, a lot of people think, well, this sounds woo and it sounds crazy. So then if you go and look at what the scientists are telling us, this is exactly the kind of scenario that has been imagined by space scientists as these, you know, say, distributing these AI probes that are self-aware, they are self-repairing, they're essentially immortal. They can sit on a planet, you know, indefinitely, repairing themselves and make contact, have communication directly with the people there. Now, another alternative, of course, is that this is indeed, you know, some kind of living extraterrestrial being, a consciousness, which is able to, in some sense we don't fully understand, move itself into this object, right? Rather than an artificial intelligence, maybe it's a natural intelligence, which has, in some way we don't understand, transferred itself into this object, okay? Now, in that scenario, it would work very much the same as the Bracewell probe. The only difference is, you know, can we differentiate between true hard AI, self-aware artificial intelligence, and an advanced alien natural intelligence? I mean, in some ways, that goes into pure philosophy, you know, what's the difference? I don't know, I could tell you what's the difference between those two. But the rest of the story would really stay the same, that you still have this alien intelligence in the object that's able to make direct contact with us, and which has been sitting on the planet, recording all of our events, and so it knows our history, right? Now, the extraordinary thing there is that in the Aboriginal stories about Turingas, they say that these things are living objects which are repositories of knowledge, which are only brought out by the highest initiated elders during particular sacred, you know, times, are not handled by the average people at all. They're kept away, you know, for everyone else. And that these are considered to be very powerful, even dangerous, you know, but very powerful objects with all this information in them. So isn't it funny that there's actually ancient, you know, mythology that totally meshes with what you were being told here?
Yes, that is fascinating. And now before we get into some of the information that's actually in the book, I'd like to know, how did you investigate some of the claims that, you know, like, say, for instance, about the ship and things like that?
I mean, I have personally met Valerie. I'll say that first. You know, when I was living in Australia, I'm now in Wales in the UK, but I lived in Australia for a couple of years. I'm fortunate enough to meet Valerie at her home, you know, spend some time with her. So in one sense, you know, that's part of investigating anyone's story is, you know, if you can meet them and talk to them face to face, obviously, you know, is ideal. The second thing, though, is, you know, I'd say I'm a fairly capable researcher in terms of, you know, the computer. You know, I can usually track down documents, you know, archaeological papers and all the rest of it. And of course, we live in a time where you are able to go into, you know, the archives online of all the main universities and stuff, you know, and do those studies, which once upon a time, we'd probably have to go to various libraries, you know, looking for books and looking for texts. And of course, we live in a new world now where you don't have to do that anymore. So I was fortunate enough to be able to track down relevant studies, which allowed me to do most of the background work from my computer in my room. So it's, I think that's one of the wonderful things about the modern age, isn't it? And obviously knowing, you know, what I did was I took the main core claims from the book, the ones that, you know, what we'd call, I suppose, the biggest claims, the ones that could possibly last through time. Yeah. Because obviously there's a lot that we don't expect to last. You know, once you start going back into thousands, indeed tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, obviously there's an awful lot you are not going to be able to prove because the evidence is long lost, right? So there was only a few key claims that I could narrow down on, being the ship, particularly obviously the genetic engineering and a couple other elements. But so yeah, that's kind of how it was done.
Oh, did you actually go in search of any of the pieces of this ship?
I did go out to a couple places where I thought it might be possible to find some, but I didn't directly find any, but instead I did get hold of some from a collector. So I mean, I do have fragments myself. I was hopeful to find some, you know, out in the wild, because you can, there are areas in the bush and stuff where you can still find these on the ground, right? The material scattered pretty widely across the southern part of Australia. So, you know, if you kind of know where on the map where these clusters of them are, there is a potential, you know, you might walk into an old dry stream bed or something and find some pieces, you know, in there. So unfortunately I didn't, but that doesn't mean that other people out in southern Australia couldn't. And there may be some listeners out there that, you know, have done. I mean, this material is called Australite Tektite. And so, you know, anyone who looks that up can certainly go out and look for it. You know, it's mapped, you know, there are a number of clusters across, you know, southern Australia. It is limited to that region. I mean, I should say I'll clarify a little bit. There's a couple of different types, but these button tektites, which have clearly come from space, right? They are limited to southern Australia. There's related material up in Southeast Asia. Now, I can go a bit into why that is and, you know, the backstory of why I think this is a craft, you know, if you like.
Well, first, let's start with the time frame of when this crash occurred, and talk a little bit about the ship first, you know, in theory.
Yeah, sure. In the initial information that Valerie received, she was told that this was a very large crystalline craft, which had been grown in a kind of crystal matrix and then had been infused with a living AI. That was a self-aware living AI, which was one with the frame of the craft. Right. So this wasn't built, you know, with hammers and screws and pieces of metal or anything like the kind of technology we imagine when we think about a spaceship. You know, it's talking literally like a living crystal, you know, that's grown to this craft, and then it has, you know, an AI uploaded directly into the silica mainframe. Now, again, some people think, well, crystal ships and stuff, you know, we think about crystals and maybe woo-woo and stuff. But again, you know, what you find is if you go and look for the leading thinkers, particularly there's a paper called, I don't know if you use, Alien Minds. Now, this is there's a paper by a leading philosopher thinker in What Would an Alien Mind Be Like? You know, this is a really fascinating paper. Basically, one of the things it talks about in that paper is we expect that most advanced alien civilizations will either be post-biological, in that they've moved beyond being biological beings, they have moved into their, you know, their technology and are now living in vast silica networks, or that they will send out such machines into space to do most of the exploring. That they wouldn't necessarily, you know, put a biological being into a craft flying around, it may not be practical, and it's obviously, you know, there's risks with that. Whereas if you can construct living ships which go out and do that for you, obviously there's a benefit, right? And the other thing is that, you know, as I say, some of these civilizations may entirely move from their physical forms into these silica networks. So a vast silica craft is actually what the leading minds on Earth expect to see from these advanced civilizations. So again, when you're getting told that from, you know, this strange kind of download, you know, I'm sure that probably Valerie thought at first, you know, this all sounds, you know, really bizarre and doesn't make any sense. Bear in mind, this was back in the early 1990s. You know, this isn't now, when we now probably would be more familiar with these ideas, right? Because, you know, we read about these studies coming out, you know, that we're moving towards quantum computing and large silica networks. Of course, back in the early 90s, that wasn't really something that anyone was particularly thinking about, right? Because, you know, we were at the beginning of our really even the home computer age, when, you know, it was playing simple games on little computers, right? So this would have sounded very peculiar, but now we understand that indeed, yeah, huge silica networks is probably the future of where, you know, AI and stuff will be born into, because essentially it can use the entire mass for its computing processes. So now, if you imagine, like, if we have what we have as a spaceship, you know, we have an onboard ship, you know, ship's computer, which would be, you know, a small part of the ship itself. Now, let's imagine you can build a ship, or in this case, grow a ship, which the entire vessel itself is the computer. Now, think of the computing power. If your entire craft is the computer and you're sitting inside, this is a kind of extraordinary technology, which I imagine that, you know, we hope to get ourselves. And it does make a lot. What I'm saying is it makes a lot of sense. Although it first sounds woo, you start realizing, no, actually, this is actually a genius design. You know, you're using the whole thing to do the computing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And based on the story, what happened with the craft? How did it get destroyed?
Sure. Yeah, so there's basically an overview of this craft arriving here. It moves through what sounds to me like a kind of wormhole entrance. There's a revolving doorway in space, which is located somewhere in the Pleiades star cluster. Now, I will clarify here that it doesn't mean that all these beings live there, right? That they, you know, in fact, there's a discussion of it being a collective of beings from different places that are on board the ship, that there's some kind of alliance out there, and that this is a mission by a number of different groups that work together. So there's no reason to assume that all these beings live in the Pleiades, right? And I know people will say, oh, the Pleiades is a young star system, you know, young star cloud, right? Which is true. But you've got to think, if you're a space-faring civilization, you can set up bases wherever you want, right? So they jump through this gateway, which takes them to Earth. And this is what we're told is somewhere between sort of 700,000 to 900,000 years ago, because there's two different dates kind of given to Valerie, I think, from their perspective and our perspective. For reasons we can sort of get to, I actually narrow this down to 780,000 years ago, right? But so this craft jumps through the gateway, arrives at Earth. There is a mission to basically have a handover of Earth from another group that are already here, and that there's supposed to have been negotiations and agreement. There's going to be this peaceful handover. What this actually turns into is basically a sort of betrayal. There's an attack. This other group that's already on Earth destroys the ship in orbit. There's not much time for people to escape, you know, for beings to escape. Some of the beings manage to get to small craft. They do escape. We're told there's 50,000 entities on board. So this is, you know, a very large craft, right? A small number, I believe, from what I understand, is in the hundreds, perhaps. You know, but there's certainly not many of them, a couple of hundred maybe, that get away in smaller craft, you know, and get down to the planet's surface. Now, one of the sort of funny overlaps again here is that we are told in this information that the ships come down in New South Wales, at a place near Carryong, New South Wales, which is kind of known in ancient mystery circles because there's the Gosford glyphs at Carryong, which are what appear to be ancient Egyptian symbols on, you know, stones at Gosford, which is just outside sort of Carryong. And that this area is where some of these ships come down, right? Now, that's was an important clue in a way, because, you know, we're also told that, you know, fragments of the larger craft are falling down, you know, raining down. They melted specifically, and then they are falling down, scattered across the planet. Now, I was thinking, when I came to looking for this, I thought, well, where might we start looking? Right? Because obviously it's a big planet, you know, where do we look for this? I thought, well, if the escape crafts come down in southern Australia, we might expect, you know, if you're fleeing something in space to come fairly directly down, right? You know, that. So I thought, well, would it be somewhere above Australia that this has happened? Yeah. Now that's kind of funny, because when you come to the part where, you know, I look to see, you know, where is this debris, you know, as we touched on earlier, it turns out that that debris is scattered specifically across southern Australia, right? Which again, matches very well with the account of them kind of crash landing down in southern Australia.
You mentioned that there was already a race here on Earth. Mm-hmm. Many theories say that there were reptilians that occupied the planet. Mm-hmm. Was it the reptilians you're referring to?
Yes. Yeah, it's a reptilian humanoid race that's already here. In fact, there's a discussion there having been two distinct races that they both, to us, we, you know, if we were to look at them, we would say, you know, reptilians, but that they are not the same, and that they shared this planet and at times had some conflicts, but more so in terms almost of using genetic engineering to create creatures that would fight each other. And that allegedly they were responsible for creating dinosaurs, doing all sorts of things here, that they've manipulated DNA over vast periods of time. And that this group was meant to hand over the planet. There was a negotiation that they'd initially taken Earth from this alliance. And now this alliance had negotiated to have Earth handed back. And that there was a kind of betrayal in these negotiation processes. And at least particularly the hostile group are linked with the Orion star system, and that we're, you know, that comes up later on in the text quite specifically, that it is an Orion centered civilization of reptilian beings, that are involved in this betrayal and this attack.
Now, when it comes to humans, you know, when we're just looking at modern day academia, even the anomalies there, the, you know, such as the big jump in our DNA, brain size, mm-hmm. all these other anomalies that occur, mm-hmm. I mean, it's obvious indicators to me that there was, that something happened that was mm-hmm. not part of the natural evolution. Now, during this time where the ship crash and they have all this turmoil, when did this species begin to start experimenting with the hominids on this planet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, I would suggest that this planet has always had experimentation going on, and that really, if we go back to the start of the story, that this is a seeded world. And that comes up as well. That comes up in that material, but also comes up elsewhere. You know, you find that pops up in different places, different cultures and stuff. The idea that that life on this planet originated from somewhere else. Now, I personally consider DNA to be a technology, a planetary terraforming technology that you can literally spray down onto a planet. And, you know, you come back, you know, a few hundred thousand years later or whatever, and you've got basic life. Right, so it will gradually turn dead worlds into vibrant biospheres, yeah, which is an incredibly useful technology, okay, and that's how I view DNA. So now, once it's established, beings have come here at different times manipulating organisms on this planet. We see even in the Cambrian period, the Cambrian explosion around 500 million years ago, there's this sudden explosion in life forms. Now, there's some leading scientists that published a paper I think it's a year or so ago, I think about 20 or 30, you know, leading scientists on the paper that said that they believe the Cambrian explosion was the result of a panspermia event, probably a retrovirus from space that infected life on this planet, added new DNA, and caused all of these new life forms to appear. Now, I think they're probably right. The only thing that they don't go to is, you know, could this have been rather than natural, you know, viral DNA just drifting through space, right? Or deliberate. Now, I would say that the argument for deliberate is much stronger, because for a virus to infect organisms on this planet, it kind of infers that it must have a link to it, or that someone understands the life on this planet and modifies a virus to infect it, right? Which means you must know what the life's like there, and you understand it, and you can modify a virus to be sure it's going to infect that life and change it. So, I mean, it's easier, I think, to argue for directed panspermia than it is for just, oh, somehow a virus that was able to infect organisms drifted through space and got here, right? And as you can understand, the academics will never go there. They'll go as far as a comet might have brought it. And in fact, in this paper, they even suggest a comet might have brought the eggs of octopus, because they think octopus is so strange, right, and has so many different evolutionary differences to us, that they actually talk about, they said that they think the evolution of the octopus appears to have borrowed from the future of evolution. Because there's things in there, you know, the strange shape-shifting, color-shifting, like abilities, right? And their ability to rewrite their own RNA, and you know, the way their eye has evolved completely different to ours. But they're saying that they suspect that it's almost as though it's got, yeah, elements of future evolution that have come from outside the terrestrial biosphere and somehow ended up in these octopus. And so they go as far as saying maybe the eggs of an octopus came here in a comet. If you think about that, that's kind of ridiculous, because, you know, how would the eggs of an octopus end up frozen in a comet? How would they survive? How would they survive entry? To me, it almost looks like we don't want to say spaceship. What can we say? We'll say comet, right? Because the spaceship makes more sense than the comet, because you could bring anything in a spaceship and leave it quite safely. But you assume a comet that somehow doesn't just hit the planet or burn up, you know, it's a strange way of delivering life. You know, the idea that whole eggs could be frozen in a comet. So look, I think that some of the academics also suspect that there is this, you know, process going on with deliberate modification, but they draw a line and say, you know, this is just somehow naturally happening, but it's from space, but without aliens, right? Because they have to pull back from their careers being like impacted, right? Which obviously I don't have that problem. You know, I'm able to say, no, let's call a spade and say that the most obvious one is directed events, not accidental events.
Now, do you think that it is anything near Sitchin's interpretations of the Sumerian mythos, where these beings were actually doing experiments on hominids and altering DNA. Do you believe it was anything along those lines?
Valerie does talk about the fact that before this kind of upgrade, you know, that the early hominins had been created to be used as kind of servile creatures and also to be used as sacrifices to the perceived gods of this reptilian group. So that, yeah, I mean, that does overlap the idea of them being a kind of a slave species that is created for to be abused, you know, but it wasn't a positive thing. They weren't creating us, you know, for any good reason. And that, you know, at the time, obviously, we're talking about small-brained humans, not like us, that would have been quite, you know, I guess, servile. They wouldn't have been able to outthink, you know, these kind of more advanced reptilian races, you know. So it does seem that that's what's suggested. And now, if you put that in the context of perhaps a mythology or a history that has been handed down or has been given back to us at some point in a contact event, and that the Sumerians have done their best to record that, and I think other cultures as well, you know, you get stories of these contact, and the manipulation story appears in various cultures. I think that what we have is almost like a Chinese whispers, though, you know, where the Sumerians and others have elements of it. They talk about the gods coming and creating us and modifying us for one reason or another. But I think that these stories are inaccurate, you know, in the same way that, you know, we wouldn't really expect the Sumerians to be able to understand some of these concepts, like all the ancient Egyptians and stuff. So like, I think they've done the best that they can to try and explain what they've been led to believe happened. Now, they didn't offer us any physical proof. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, anyone can write a story, right? You know, anyone can write a story. You can write it on stone, you can write it on tablets, you can write it in a book. It's still just a story without supporting, you know, strong supporting evidence. Now, obviously, all these different slightly conflicting narratives about the visitation and the DNA upgrades, you know, are all around the world. And they all are somewhat conflicting, but tell us the basic story of visitation, modification. Now, where this one is different, you know, obviously Valerie's overlaps. Again, you have a story with the same theme. But the difference, of course, is when we look for evidence. And that's where my work comes in, of course, because the one time I have all these stories where we actually get physical evidence that strongly supports this.
Now, that being said, what do you think would be the purpose for these advanced beings to upgrade us in such a way that, you know, we have these conscious capabilities and we're, you know, the Homo sapiens that you see today?
Mm-hmm. Sure, that is explained, actually. Yeah. After the ship's arrival and its destruction, the few survivors that have come down to the planet's surface, they kind of realize that they are not going to survive long term. Now, so keep in mind, this is a second group who are more benevolent, you know, rather than the reptilian group, which is more malevolent, right? That there is, even among the reptilians, we're told some of them don't really understand why they've blown this ship up. They don't really see what the point was, because it wasn't there threatening them or anything, you know. So even amongst them, there is some sympathy, and that's kind of clarified. At least a few reptilians actually help the survivors, you know, and sort of don't think it was the right thing to have done. But these survivors decide that, look, they can't survive, but they can, instead of colonizing the planet and doing it, you know, the handover and all these things that they initially planned, they realize that what they can do instead is modify the existing humans that are there, upgrade them, you know, in their view, especially what we call an upgrade, and not only for the good of that species. I mean, they do talk about having some sympathy, you know, for these early humans, but also there is a kind of, we might call it, sort of self-interest in this as well, because they talk about the fact that they realize that they can utilize these upgraded human bodies to incarnate into themselves. Now, this is an ability most people straight away maybe think, wow, well, that sounds, you know, really fantastical and, you know, made up or whatever, which I understand. But if we look at the Tibetan Buddhists, you know, today, and we look at their claims, they tell us that, you know, a high lama, you know, these people that have meditated most of their lives and are considered to have extraordinary psychic abilities, right? That when these high lamas pass on, they often choose the moment of their death and are able to choose their next life, right? And they direct their consciousness into a new body and leave leave certain directions about where they will be born. Like they'll say, you know, in a village near the mountain, there'll be a rainbow and some birds will fly over the house. And they'll give a whole list of signs, right? And then the monks will go looking for those signs and often find a child. They would test them. They will bring artifacts that the person knew and others, you know, mix them together. And the child be asked, you know, do you recognize any of these, right? And in many cases, the child not only spots all the artifacts that used to be theirs, but is able to recite long Buddhist texts in Pali and Sanskrit and stuff, like, you know, 6-year-old kids, 5-year-old kids, reciting entire, you know, scriptures of Buddhist thought, right? So there is a precedent on earth amongst humans for this strange ability to focus your consciousness into a selected rebirth. Now, if we take that and say, okay, so we've got evidence for that, why couldn't super advanced extraterrestrials do the same thing? And that's what they say they can do, right? And so they incarnate, as they die, because of the radiation, the atmosphere, the food types here, which they're not compatible with, which again makes sense, right? You know, they've lost their mothership. The intention was to slowly genetically modify themselves to be more suitable to the planet. So that process had been underway on the way to Earth, but they was not complete. And they were not able to fully live here. And so they're dropping off like flies because of all the environmental issues that you have on an alien world. Again, which speaks to the reality of this. Because if this was they landed and they could live happily on Earth, we should be suspicious, right? Because it'd be quite unlikely that if humans crashed on an alien world, it would be entirely suitable for us. Yeah, we would expect to be to lots of different hostilities in the environment. And that's exactly the case for them too. And so many of them are dying. They realize that what they can do is utilize what's left of their technology to modify the existing hominin, make it a bit more like them, help it to sort of free it away from this reptilian influence, which is part of why they're there, to take the planet away from that influence, and also utilize those bodies for themselves. As they die, they reincarnate back into the bodies. Totally, I understand, for anyone to think, well, that's totally beyond what I can accept. And that's fair enough. All I can say is, that's what they claim, and that we have some evidence in, certainly in Buddhism, that this really is an ability of humans and we assume other beings.
Now, what anomalies can you point out in the genetic code that indicates that, you know, there was a major upgrade to what we are as Homo sapiens?
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's obviously a massive part of this. I mean, it was one thing to sort of identify part of the ship, you know, because I was quite satisfied that we have that. We can go back to that in a minute, why I say that. But I was quite satisfied we had the debris, this Australite tektite, you know, in Australia. But of course, you know, the real story is the modification of humans, you know, and without evidence of that, it would just be, you know, yeah, it'd still be an amazing story, you know, and it'd still be amazing to find this debris. But obviously what we're interested in is, do humans have a link to extraterrestrials? You know, what is our backstory? Who are we? Where are we from? And where are we going? And clearly, if we've been modified and upgraded by aliens, that answers a lot of questions. So I was fortunate in that I had already written a book called The Forgotten Exodus, The Inter-Africa Theory of Human Evolution, right? Which in that, I'd had to read all kinds of papers, you know, about human evolution, our early migrations, and basically most of the big story of events going back to the last 6 million years, okay? So having already done that, I knew some of the papers with the anomalies in them. Now I'll go through some of these anomalies. What we have, first of all, is very well understood, is that around about 800,000 years ago, if you look in the fossil record, you find there's a sudden acceleration in the cranial capacity of early humans, right? Now, there is one before that, there's an acceleration around 1.8 million years ago, but that one is a bit more in line with body size, okay? Because obviously we actually grow, you know, physically grew bigger, okay? So the head grew bigger in proportion. So this is a bit different. What you find though at around 800,000 years ago is the cranium is growing out of proportion to the body. It just seems to be a brain size change, okay? Now, for a very long time, this has been considered an anomalous event, you know, but we didn't have any scientific way of evaluating what was going on, right? So it was just a mystery in the human story. Why did that happen? Who knows? We just know it did. Yeah. Now we live in a different era where we have genomic science. Okay. So we've been able to move beyond the, you know, simply seeing these skulls to being able to sample ancient DNA and find out what is going on, you know, and to be able to look into the brain, understand structures in the brain, look at the genes that give us certain structures in the brain. You know, all of that has now been done. And what you start finding is that there is clear evidence of anomalies around that time, which give us this brain. And in fact, there's hundreds of differences between chimps and other primates and us, hundreds in the brain, in to do with the brain. Not, you know, one or two, or, you know, natural change where you could say, you know, or where we have equally distributed changes across all systems in the body, right? That, again, you could say, well, random evolution, you know, there's all these changes. Instead, we have nearly all of the differences between us and other primates are clustered in areas to do with the brain. Does that sound random to anyone? It doesn't sound very random, does it? Right? When we think of that word random. So suddenly there's all these strange anomalies that appear that relate to genes that produce elements of our new brain. Now, in amongst those, there's a few that really stand out, because, you know, what I found was that in like one of them, I mean, I can't remember the name of particular genes, but there was one that the scientists actually describe it as having, they said, appeared fully formed out of the non-coding DNA. Like, so you put that context, like the area that we used to call junk DNA, you know, there's lots of material there that supposedly doesn't do much, that suddenly some of it formed into a brain gene, just out of nowhere. It just turns into a brain gene, and that gene gives us, I think it's through the neocortex, and, you know, an area of the surface of the brain gives us more capacity for processing. And so, you know, isn't that fortunate that this gene just appears fully formed out of nowhere and gives us this remarkable, you know, aspect of the brain? Now, there was another one, which again is to do with a very important area of the brain, where they said, you know, looking at it, it appears to be a very short segment of a longer gene. And they said, it almost looks as if it was cut out, Xeroxed, you know, and put back in. And, you know, you see a scientist use words like Xeroxed, and you're thinking, hey, obviously they're thinking this is super weird. You know, they've got no other language to put it other than it looks like someone's copied it, you know, like we do with like CRISPR, you know, gene editing technologies. It looks like someone snipped out a piece, you know, replicated it and added that snipped segment in. And, you know, that's the language these people are talking about. Snipped, you know, cut pieces, copied, put back in, genes appearing out of nowhere. And that all of these give us fantastical upgrades to how the brain works, right? Now, isn't that awfully odd and convenient, right? And it turns out that there's a lot of others that are really odd. I mean, we've got, bear in mind as well, we've got probably most famously around this time, we've got the fusion of chromosome 2 as well. Now, fusion of chromosome 2 has long been pointed to not only in the ancient aliens kind of circles, but also in the creationist, you know, the intelligent design, right, religious creationism, that they also highlight this, because the scientists in, you know, in those quite well-funded organizations, you know, have also noticed that, hey, there's a lot of anomalies around the fusion of chromosome 2, right, for a start. Normally, chromosome errors are problematic. Right, usually they're horribly problematic, right? So it wouldn't be expected for them to actually confer any good for us, if anything, neutral or very bad things to happen. Yeah. Now, instead, we find with chromosome 2 that there is such a benefit that all other humans on Earth are replaced. Right? What the hell's going on there? Because we would expect there to be a small subpopulation, right, with 46 chromosomes in a much larger population of 48 who are carrying this problem, right? But instead, we see a total global replacement, right? That's a bit odd, right? So in other words, and to work this out, they said that it must be that whatever the fusion did, it is so beneficial that it became so prevalent. And on top of that, it most likely started in a small, isolated population where it could become prevalent and totally endemic. Well, that's like in a lab, right? A small, isolated population where, you know, it's breeding. You know, it's like, hang on a minute. That's specifically what, you know, we would have in a controlled experiment, isolated population problem. With this upgrade being done, with this amazing benefit, they've shown that it's fused in such a way as it's on a gene, which is to do with the brain, the reproductive system, and the immune system, key areas you might want to get to, right, if you're modifying a hominin. And on top of that, there is, although it's very similar to the same region in other primates, there seems to be additional and missing material. Again, so it's not just a normal fusion where you'd see, okay, we'd see the same basic genes as in our close relative. No, it looks like there's bits that have been removed, bits that have been added at the fusion site, right? Again, which is fused on this active gene, which is not normal. It's not heard of in other fusion events. It's on an active gene. And one of the ways this recently has been sort of dated, because this is an argument about when it happened. Like, one of the things that we found out is that Denisovans, Neanderthals, and modern humans all had this fusion, right? So all the large-brained humans had it. Okay, so it confers. We know that it begins at the beginning of that split, first of all. So all of these large-brained hominins have it. Now, to how do we know how far back it goes? That was the other issue, because for a long time, nobody's really been known the dates. And this has been an issue, because if you look at, say, Lloyd Pye, who used to write on these topics, and unfortunately passed away from cancer a few years ago, you know, he highlighted chromosome 2, but when he was still alive, we had no dating on it, right? So he just inferred probably it was something to do with like the Sumerian story and whatnot. But now we know that it was there at the beginning of this, you know, the split between Denisova and Neanderthals. That gives us a minimum. Now there's a British, I think he's a molecular chemist or biologist, who went into the, you know, what you can find is if you look at the way that changes occur in the chromosomes at the ends versus the middle, which is there's a different rate of change because, of course, at the ends, more change can occur than in the middle. There could be more errors and stuff. He said he was able to calculate roughly when this had started, you know, the change in the duration of evolution had happened. Look, I won't pretend to fully understand it because I'm not a molecular chemist, right? So I rely on someone else's research. And what he came to the conclusion of was that this happened not too much further back than 750,000 years ago. Okay. And funnily enough, in the last couple of years, it has now been the split between Denisovans, Neanderthals, and us has been dated at between sort of 750 to 800,000 years ago. So in other words, we now have a minimum maximum that are basically at the same point, which is around this 750 to 800,000 years ago. And we now already have the date we've been talking about 780,000 years ago, which is right in the middle of that range, right? So we can basically infer that, yeah, 780,000 years ago, we have the chromosome 2 fusion on top of the other things that are happening. And when did that skull size increase? Around 800,000 years ago, right? So very close to that 780,000 years ago, we get the physical changes, we get the chromosome 2 changes, and we now also know there's a whole slew of brain gene, you know, anomalies. And without sort of laboring this point, I will add in one other aspect, which is quite recent, which many people won't know about, which I go into in a bit more depth in the book, is that there's also a category of information in the genome called human accelerated regions. Now, as the name maybe infers to people straight away, these are regions where evolution seems to have been accelerated, right? And so this is very recent, in the last, I think, the last 10 years, really, that this research has been going on. They found that there were, well, it's now, I think, several hundred of these segments. And these are, you go into areas of non-coding DNA, and you find that there's these short segments that seem to go through a rapid process of evolution. Now, if it's okay, I'll just quickly backtrack a little bit. I want to explain why it's important where they are. Because if you go to, you know, anyone can search online for, you know, what would we expect if there was a message in the DNA? Because obviously there are scientists that theorize perhaps a message from aliens could be encoded in DNA, right? And so when you look for, you know, papers or you look for websites on this, they say, well, you know, it would have to be in a certain part of the genome. Because of evolution, because of mutations, a message in our genome would be lost because mutations would eradicate it over time, over hundreds of thousands, millions, hundreds of millions of years. You know, it wouldn't persist. He said, but now if you make a change in what's called highly conserved non-coding DNA, which is areas which are unbelievably stable because they're for such important functions in the organism that they almost never change, right? That a message or changes that are made there could persist almost indefinitely, right? So that's an important point. And so now it turns out that they've found hundreds of changes in highly conserved non-coding DNA, the exact region where we're told aliens would leave a message. Isn't that kind of funny? But that's exactly what we're finding. And we find there hundreds of these accelerated regions. Now, what do they do? I mean, amongst them, what we know are, we don't know all of them yet, right? But we do know that many of them are to do with the fetal development of the brain. Straight away, again, we're back to the brain. We're back to the changes in the fetus and, you know, that lead to changes in the brain. And that they're not genes What they are is they're kind of genetic switches. So they can turn on a gene, turn off a gene. They can make a gene express stronger. So like if you got, let's say you have a finger gene, you can make the finger twice as long by the gene expressing its information stronger, right? Now, this is really important because for a long time in ancient aliens theories, it was thought that there was a kind of a hybridization where alien DNA is fused into humans, right? That's kind of a popular kind of suspicion, let's call it. Now, that was kind of quite reasonable to think in a way, but this actually shows that no, they were beyond that, that they understood the genome so well, they could play us like a piano, right? They could go in, they knew how to make your arm longer, your head bigger, all that stuff, just by changing these switches with the genes, mostly the genes that are already there. They don't need to add in loads of alien DNA. Now, that doesn't mean that they may not have transferred information from other species, because humans have a couple of hundred genes which do seem to come from what's called horizontal gene transfer, which is like directly from other organisms, mushrooms, like fungi, bacteria, viruses. We do have those. Now, it's possible in amongst those that some of that is alien DNA, possibly, right? But the other thing is, it's possible that they took stuff from other organisms on Earth, right? Which would be useful in the same way we do today. We do this, you know, we mix organisms together. We've got, you know, you get spider, you know, silk into a sheep and things like that, right? We're doing that. So they could well have done the same. That may be why we're finding so much of this, you know, horizontal gene transfer in humans. It may not all be accidental, right? Because they may be using what's on hand, taking something from, you know, a mushroom, taking something from another animal, putting it in there, and also modifying expression of existing genes. They don't need to start splicing in loads of alien DNA. So that's actually, I found that quite a revelation, because it was like that clicks and you realize these beings are well beyond, you know, they understand the genome in a way that we cannot comprehend, Our genetic engineering is nowhere near that. If we tried to mess with one of these highly conserved areas, we'd almost certainly kill any organism that we did that to, because again, these are areas that probably, you know, give you your lungs, or, you know, the ability to you know, have a heart, or, you know, really core. I mean, just to try and explain a little bit better in case, because I know this is complex. One of the studies they did, and this is the first human accelerated region, is called HAR1. Now, they compared it across species. They found it in the chicken, chimpanzee, and humans. Now, what they found is that in this, say, 223 DNA letter long segment, if I remember right, in the chicken and the chimpanzee, they found three letters were different. Now, those species have been separated by 300 million years. So if you one successful change every 100 million years or so, okay? So that's pretty stable, pretty darn stable. You know, it shows that when there's an error, most of the time, the organism dies, yeah? So a very slow rate of evolution. Now, they went across to the humans to compare with the chimp. Chimp's only supposed to be separate from us for about maybe 7 million years, right? So they were expecting zero differences. Instead, they found, I think it's 23 differences, 23 letter differences, versus those two between the chicken and the chimp. Now, that is just mind-bending, because, you know, when they look, they ran the numbers on this. And, you know, actually, the lady who did this, she's actually a... she writes programs that run the statistics. She's a biostatistician, right? So she designed the program to work out what's the chances, you know, how could this happen? And it threw out that there was basically a 0% chance of it happening by any understood evolutionary mechanism, right? A 0% chance. So it has to be something that we don't understand at all in any of our models of evolution.
Fascinating science experiment as a planet. It's amazing. Now, before we run out of time, I want to talk about the components of the pieces of the ship. Tell us a little bit about what you have found that makes this up.
Yeah, I mean, that was quite a story, because obviously we had a description of a very large ship, crystalline, so I knew it'd be largely silica. We are told it, you know, explodes in orbit, and that the melted debris flies down, you know, it's falling down everywhere. So I went looking for this in the scientific records. I thought, you know, perhaps we could find something there that would help us. And it turned out that they have this material, austrolite tektite, which has been a mystery to science for 100 years, right? So I was like mind bent because, you know, you're thinking there's no way I'm going to find anything. Now, this is so long ago, 780,000 years ago, right? And it turns out that, yes, this material exists. Yes, it's anomalous. Science hasn't explained it away. It's 75% silica. It's rained down across, you know, 10 to 30% of the world has some traces of it, right? So over a huge area, right, like something breaking up in space. And that the some parts of it, these button tektites, are definitively came from space. I mean, these have been NASA studies, not me sitting here, you know, thinking, you know, oh, how do I fit this into it? But no, the NASA papers, so, you know, we worked out the only way they could have formed is if droplets of melted crystalline material, like solidified in space as little balls, and as those came down at a shallow, basically like a decaying orbit kind of angle, that they melted again into these button shapes, because they had to have formed in orbit. Now that's a problem because Earth is not supposed to capture large objects like that. It's really difficult, you know, really rare that we would have that happen. You know, I come the exact wrong, but every time you look, into this, basically astronomers say it's so extraordinarily unlikely that very occasionally Earth might capture some small object. I think at the moment there's something the size of a car that's been caught. But we're talking about something about 1 or 2 kilometers in diameter. That's what they calculate from the amount of debris. So this is a large object, right? That is, that it's broken up, it's come down. The material has been studied many times, you know. So I didn't have to go, you know, and find it and try and arrange a test, you know, because this has been well studied by academics. So again, it's not me doing this, or anyone can say Bruce is just doing pseudoscience or making it up. It's like, you know, there's hundreds of papers on this. Now, it turns out that there is no crater. So the idea of it being an impact has always been a problem. And there's two different camps in science. One who say it's an impact, one who say it must be from outer space, right? And neither side has won that argument, because whichever way you go with it, there's huge anomalies. One is that if it's an impact, how does the material end up in space, liquid, molten still, because it has to travel through the whole atmosphere back into space? Well, it wouldn't be liquid anymore, it'd be solidified. And yet the pieces have hard vacuum bubbles in them. So they clearly formed in space, right? And so they haven't been able to resolve that. And then the ones who say it's from space, they have problems about the composition because it's not made of lunar rock, which they think, oh, it must be from the moon. It's not made of lunar rock. So these two sides have been arguing for decades. And the only thing that immediately fixes it is a large silica craft that's parked itself in orbit, exploded, and, you know, it's rained down debris. There's no need for a crater, no need to involve the moon, right? And that suddenly all of the different arguing points go away and it resolves the anomaly, right? That's the mad thing about it. And it dates to 780,000 years ago, the same time as the changes in the early humans, right? We have it as a hand-in-glove fit.
Yeah, that's definitely compelling evidence. I want to get your thoughts on the findings of the elongated skulls. Brian Forrester does tons of research on this. He's had DNA testing done on it. The results came back quite interesting. Do you think that these elongated skulls were some sort of ancient version of humans, or were they possibly different off planet? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've pondered this. I mean, and I've, you know, I've put a little short video about it before online, tackling some of the DNA stuff and my thoughts. I mean, one of the things I reckon that we may have here is two things. I think that we know that ancient hominins had more elongated heads. Okay, that's the first. That's understood. That if we go back to Neanderthals and Homo erectus, their skulls were more elongated. Not necessarily, you know, crazily so, but they were more elongated than ours. So the first thing is, could there have been a population of early humans that had very elongated skulls? I think there's no particular reason why that couldn't have been the case. Now, the other thing is, did these visitors have elongated skulls? And the description says yes, that yes, they themselves had it. So are we emulating these visitors? You know, is there a mythology that says, you know, that these space visitors, the ancestors, had elongated heads, right? And so we also may be replicating that when we do these deliberate elongations. But it is possible as well that there is a throwback, you know, there's a population with a gene, you know, is a throwback to this time when we had elongated heads. And that may relate back to this first modification. You know, there may be, again, links going through it. Now, I don't think that the elongated head people in Peru are directly aliens. I think that's been well established. The DNA shows that they are a human population, absolutely human. But there's clearly is, you know, there are oddities, you know, just fairly striking. You know, even if you say that you think they've been deliberately done, you've still got this issue of why, oh, why would anyone want to stretch their head to these unbelievable degrees, right? But also there are other things there. I think they detected in some of the Paracas people that there's traces of an unknown archaic hominin. Now, something related to either Neanderthals or Denisovans, but not necessarily Neanderthals or Denisovans. So there may be traces of an ancestral American, you know, lost hominin population that may have given some genes to these people. And that may be why we're seeing these elongated heads. And also they may remember, you know, in their stories, these people that had them. So it's a complex issue. And again, it may relate back to these first, you know, these space visitors.
Now, moving forward to today, do you think that, say, the reptilians, there's plenty of theories that reptilians mm-hmm. in the world right now, that they actually still have some sort of control or communication or manipulation of humans that goes on today? And if so, is it involved with some sort of secret space program that we may have? Mm-hmm.
I do, in my, again, I could I absolutely prove it? No, but I do hold the conviction that, yes, that they are still interfering in our affairs, that, yes, they're still here. And, you know, if you look at the mythologies around the world, the right from, you know, Aboriginals across into, you know, Africa, you go to, obviously, Bible-type stories, you know, you're finding the references again and again to these reptilian humanoids, right, that have meddled with us. In some cases, you know, done quite horrific things to people if you listen to the accounts, and even today, and of course in alien abduction experiences, people seem to encounter these beings and have mostly negative experiences, not always, but mostly negative experiences, right? So there is a continuation of that phenomena. Now, okay, some people might say, oh well, it's all, you know, psychological, it's all in your imagination. Well, it's funny though, isn't it, that, you know, we have it going back to all these different cultures, and that even in this story that we're talking about, all the way back to 780,000 years ago, again, it's these reptilian humanoids. There is a continuity in this story. And I do feel that, yeah, today we are still dealing with their influence. And indeed that, you know, that there are two sides playing, you know, at work here, a minimum two sides. You know, if we say this is a 5D chess game, there's at least two advanced, you know, collectives at work here. And that's one of the reasons why doesn't someone just invade, or why don't we see open conflicts? Well, if you imagine there's a much more complex exopolitical situation involving fairly balanced powers, right, that what we see as a simple warfare probably would be, you know, really, really mind-bendingly complicated, on top of which neither side would necessarily want to go to a full hot war over this planet, right? But there's probably other ways these situations get solutions, right? My feeling is we choose who it is we want to end up with, and that there is some kind of an agreement between them, that in the same, like the Bible stories, if you like, you sell your soul to the devil, doesn't just take you, right? And that kind of mythology is pretty common in other cultures as well, the idea that you choose to be damned, right? So are we given the choice of who are you going to align with? Are you going with the reptilian empire, or are you going to go with our alliance? No one's going to absolutely force you. We'll play games with, you know, you will have us visit, we will do things here, but no one's going to absolutely force the planet to do something. It'll be a choice, and then the other lot has to leave. Now, that's a scenario that I strongly suspect. I think that in the end, we have to be very careful that we're not walking into an agreement where our help just turns away and leaves and says, well, they've chosen, you know, because that's a nightmare. It's, you know, if that's the scenario, that is the nightmare. So I think we should be very wary that if we see the symbolism appearing in our culture, which we do, I'd say reptilian type symbolism, behaviors, even elements from Valerie's book, we have this description of them in these, like what I would say is like royal family types, right? With they've got the robes, red robes, and holding their orbs and their crowns, like royal families on earth. So look, where's that coming from? That idea of these special bloodlines and these special, you know, pomp and ceremony, which is a reptilian brainstem type thing, right? Rituals and those kind of aspects of humanity to do with the reptilian brainstem, right? That we seem to have taken on some characteristics from these entities. And I think that we're kind of sleepwalking into actually going with them You know, I really hope that's not the case. That's my feeling. And again, you know, a lot of ancient cultures seem to point to that idea that, yeah, you can end up choosing between them. And I do suspect as well, when we see, you know, sometimes you hear these stories of crafts coming down, right, that there's crashes. Now, I find it's very unlikely that we shot down a craft like in the 40s with machine guns or something, right? Because, you know, if these are advanced craft, you know, either they're being deliberately dropped, you know, like a kind of, as a gift from the gods, or as a poison chalice, right? Or someone else is bringing them down who's got better weapons than we have, right? Because I don't think we're machine gunning, you know, alien technology out of the sky. I just don't buy it, right? And people say, oh, we shot down a craft in Roswell. Don't buy it. I don't buy it. If it's shot down, it wasn't by us, right? So it's possible that there's still sparks in these cold wars between vast civilizations that people can't comprehend, and that every now and again, a spark falls from the sky. You know, there still is skirmishes, you know, now and again. That is my suspicion again. And that would explain some of these accounts of strange things that come, you know, hurtling out of the sky. I honestly don't believe it's us shooting them down.
The final part of that is about our secret space program. Do you think that we're sharing technology with these beings, and that we have off-planet operations, possibly on the moon, maybe on Mars? How far do you think that may be going right now?
I suspect that we probably, that there's been interaction, and that there are black projects which have been helped by these intelligences. Mostly, I suspect, on the negative side, that, you know, that we've been given perhaps weapons. Because look, there's another, like, you know, people's scenarios to think about. But let's say a negative collective is here, and maybe has always been here, and that, you know, its other competitor is here trying to help us. Now, wouldn't it be handy to give us weapons and convince us that the help is the invasion, right? And then give us weapons to repel the invasion, so that when help arrives, we open fire with these, you know, alien weapons and start shooting down our allies. And so they just say, okay, that's it. You know, again, this is another problem. And there's a lot of people don't think about it, but you think, hang on, you start to conceptualize these scenarios. Like, why don't the good guys just come and land? Well, look, if we've already working with the others and they're giving us weapons, you know, then that could be a terrible problem, because they would look like invaders. As soon as their ships arrive, the governments working with these other beings would just announce, an alien invasion has begun, right? Everyone repel them. And luckily, we've been developing secret weapons that we can fight them with, which I don't think we're capable of. I think we may have been given technologies. Again, these are gifts, and perhaps, you know, deliberately crash craft. But yeah, we may well have some very crazy stuff. Or, you know, information that's downloaded into scientists. You know, downloads seem to happen a lot. People get information, even what we're talking about, kind of a download. That, you know, that if a scientist is given the blue type in his brain, you know, to build a weapon, right, that kind of thing, that why not? Because we know that there's cases of, like, these, you know, geniuses who say that they got maths formulas that appeared from Indian gods and stuff in their heads. And, you know, that has been going on a long time, the gifts of the gods, right? So it's quite possible, I think, that, yeah, that there's some element of that. I don't think that we have Earth advanced spaceships flying around the solar system. I do suspect we may have been given things for, you know, Earth-based weaponry and orbital-based weaponry. That is quite possible. And obviously, under the cover of this whole, you know, space force, that, you know, if we're getting told that space is going to be militarized, then it's already been militarized, because you don't get that said to you first. No one announces that. Like, and it's very naive if people think the weaponization of space is just beginning. Nobody announces that until you've already done it, because otherwise you open up a space race between different groups, right? And the Chinese, the Russians, everyone be like, well, we've got to get weapons. You only say that if you've already got things up on satellites and you feel you've got domination of space, okay? So that is something you have to think about. I don't want to derail too much, but if anyone's familiar with 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is, funny enough, it links a lot with my book, when you've got this black crystalline material, right, which the Oscillite Tektite, weird black crystalline material, which seems to be an AI, right? In the thing, we have, these are the machines of the gods, right? And this, we have this AI material. Again, I do suspect Arthur C. Clarke and Kubrick were in the know, because bear in mind, these were not just your average people. They were very well-connected people, both very well-connected people, different kinds of connections. Clarke was definitely an insider in some very negative networks. I think that Kubrick was actually concerned for humanity. If you look at some of his films, look at Eyes Wide Shut, about the guy knew that there was a cult. He knew that there he had the problems. I think that film encodes some of this story. But one of the things, you know, right at the beginning, we have the upgrade is weapons, right? The upgrade is use the bone to kill the other people, right? It's weapons. And then it cuts, and we are shown, you know, a scene in space. Now, for a long time, I always thought that was just we cut to a spaceship. But it's clarified, no, that's an orbital weapons platform, right? So what's he telling us? Is he telling us that that's when we hit that moment with the orbital weapons platform is when contact and all this other stuff unlocks, right? And all these events in the film unlock when we put that weapon in space. And like, funnily enough, here we are putting the weapons in space and it seems like there's a contact going on and I found the black material, the AI material, it's there. So I think that there was a Kubrick telling us something in that film and we're right in that whatever he was trying to warn us about, it's here.
Yes, we definitely live in fascinating, sometimes terrifying times, but I'm always glad to learn more. And Bruce, thank you so much for coming on tonight. That was fantastic. Before you head out, let everyone know where they can find your books, websites, social media, anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. If people want to find my books, they're on Amazon. If you look for, you know, Bruce Fenton on Amazon, you'll find both of them. The new book was coming out June 1st, Exogenesis, and my other book, The Forgotten Exodus, are on there. The other, Hybrid Humans, is no longer available due to agreements about the new book. But they can also find me on Twitter under Exogenesis HH, and I do answer questions and stuff there. I'm on Facebook, and on my websites are brucefenton.info, ancientnews.net, and hybridhumans.net. And also, some people see me on Ancient Aliens. I appear on there sometimes, you know, so keep an eye out. Hopefully they keep having me back. So I look forward to connecting with people. If they have questions, you know, they can get hold of me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on and you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was fun. Thank you.